So you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the hosts and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
This program covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective. For the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy, a left that is of itself and for itself, the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. This show proudly waves the flags of the three lefts.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, and with me co-host...
Michael Walsh, hello.
Welcome, welcome. Let's just jump into what you're going to tell me.
Oh, so I have written down a little prediction.
Yes. So just to start off the show, we're going to talk about election issues before October hits us, and then we'll go back to our usual left-wing strategy sessions. But we're going to take a break and just talk about the forthcoming election cycle. And various takes on strategy and voting and a little bit of RBG in the Supreme Court as well. Let's see if we can fit that in. So, but first, ring and roll.
So my prediction, it's not exactly happy and optimistic, but I have two predictions. My first prediction is, let's say Biden wins. Trump refuses to give up power. And the rural parts of America back him. New York, California, and the rest of the blue states leave the Union and reverse civil war. At the same time, the left in blue America attempts to start the revolution in cities and sets up defended autonomous zones. These zones gradually start to expand as the military is distracted on the front with the red states. My second prediction is Trump wins. Trump fixed the results and then abolishes term limits. Heil Trump.
So a few counterpoints there. One, Trump is not popular in the military, and you don't really get to stay in power if the military is not behind you.
That's true.
They're not going to be on his side there. So he will likely be forced to step down when the Joint Chiefs basically walk in as a posse.
But that prediction was written...
He doesn't have the ability to actually, quote-unquote, not leave office. Second, we don't have the capability to set up citywide autonomous zones, nor would the mass population, even if it's all liberal, want that. I mean, they want to preserve the Union. And I don't think they can imagine preserving the Union by breaking from it. The thing is, like, they're saying, like, this is our last chance to keep the system as legitimate or something, to save the legitimacy of the system. And I don't think the question's ever asked of what if the system was either already illegitimate, which we believe it is.
Yeah.
But let's say he wins and it is illegitimate. What will you do? This follow-up, I haven't heard such a thing. Maybe we could look that up ourselves. But I don't believe there is a substantial answer behind any of that.
But that prediction, I wrote it before the breaking news that happened last night. Mm-hmm. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, may her memory be a blessing.
Sure. As fellow Jews, we know what to say.
Yeah.
So I have something from Left Voice,
okay,
which is, I guess, international, yes. And they're also the Trotskyist kind of publication. So it's titled, RBG or not, abolish the Supreme Court. So this is the radical take that I kind of have of, well, I don't consider the Supreme Court legitimate in the first place. And the whole, like, we need to worry about who's on it, worry about who's president. I mean, the fight is really just, you know, there's whole, like, short-term practical thinking of, like, we need to be thinking about who's currently in these seats of power when really we want to dismantle these powerful seats. Yeah. To solve the problem, if you think like we want to solve a problem and not just keep it going until the moment's right. Well, what's the right moment? When we are in fact on fire?
Yeah.
Well, that moment is quickly coming. Yeah. As multiple, now it's sections of the country, little places in the country. It doesn't have to be the whole country. You know, when it comes to a large country like ours, a large nation, you know, there's always the thought of balkanization. How would the country be split up? There's many different ways. There's metropolitan areas. But, of course, the future would be less city-based, not more city-based.
Yeah.
Though trends would say more urbanization. But that's just the way our economy has consolidated and monopolized, where the jobs or the livelihoods are in the cities. So, anyway, Ruth Gay Ginsburg died Friday night, sent millions into a panic about the future of reproductive and other civil rights. The fact that one unelected body has that much power is undemocratic to the highest degree. We should abolish it. Skipping ahead to make the point now. The decision about who to place on the Supreme Court is exceedingly important, in part because it is not out of the question that the results of this election will be decided by that court. Democrats and Republicans have assembled an army of constitutional lawyers ready to contest the election. This is the real army. It's the real fight. It's not on the streets. No, that's all just
it's in the courtrooms. Show.
After all, and that's where exactly why I don't want it to be.
Yeah.
Because, it's the people with the most lawyers wins.
Yeah, I don't want the lawyers to be the front lines of the revolution.
And I don't want, and I never liked the idea of lawyers deciding what our rights are.
Yeah.
And you kind of see this if you actually study Supreme Court history. Which I basically read, it was a book of primary source documents of American history, and it basically listed every major Supreme Court decision, not just the ones that were good for civil rights, but all the ones that were bad for civil rights.
Yeah.
And guess what? The ratio of bad to good is like 8-1. There has been way more times where the Supreme Court have ruled against people and working people and against civil rights, and then there's the one decision that, like Brown versus Board of Education, that was the nice one. But it was basically a 10-20 year stint where you had more liberal judges than not. But that's not mostly the case. When it's an exception that the good times are here, that's not a system that we should be considering legitimate. We could see a similar scenario this time. We'll go on. See, we say in no uncertain terms, we defend the right to vote. Elections shouldn't be decided by judges that no one elected. And you know what institution has stood out on the opposite side of that fight? Supreme Court. From Citizens United, that allowed unlimited corporate money, to the 2000 election, Supreme Court has been integral to maintaining the lack of democracy in the U.S., where we don't even decide elections by the basic principle of a popular vote. At the same time, an electoral strategy to defend our basic rights is doomed to fail. If defending reproductive justice or even democracy relies on an 87-year-old staying alive, it doesn't work. And having RBG on the Supreme Court was certainly no bulwark against these decisions. After all, she was on the court during Bush v. Gore. But it is indeed true that the working class and oppressed generally, as well as our basic right to vote, are under attack. We should respond accordingly, strengthening our organizations of the working class and the oppressed, doing things on the ground. After all, and it just mentions all the time Democrats and these so-called liberals that we need on the benches have actually ruled against reproductive rights. To that end, we must recognize that the Dems, for all their nice words about supporting the right to choose, are also our enemies in this fight. After all, there is a fair share of anti-abortion Dems, and Nancy Pelosi herself has said that abortion is not a central issue for her party. It is a capitalist party and exists to protect those interests. Over the next few weeks, the discussion will be dominated by who will replace Ginsburg. As socialists, or lefties, we can't get stuck in that debate. The Supreme Court is an illegitimate, undemocratic, and oppressive institution. Why should 9 unelected people who are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year and serve for life get to decide whether we have the right to an abortion? Why should they decide whether we can be fired for being queer? Why should they get to decide anything about our lives? The Supreme Court was created to protect the interests of the ruling class. It has ruled time and time again against us and any oppressed people. When the Supreme Court has come down on the side of progressive causes, it was only because of pressure from movements in the streets, not some abstract concept of justice. That certainly was the case with civil rights movement, reproductive justice movements, and how just, after all, in any institution, an institution that includes amongst ranks at least two men accused of sexual assault. We cannot sit by and hope that this or that justice doesn't die just because they are the only thing standing between us and basic civil rights. The only way to fix this court is to abolish it.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it at that. And this was written by Tiana Cozzarelli. Posted just yesterday, of course.
I'm not optimistic about the future. I saw the notification that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and I was like, oh, this is it. This is the moment.
It's the moment all the liberals feared.
Yeah.
And couldn't, and were once again powerless to do anything about it. A progressive assemblyman was giving me his best argument for, say, voting lesser evil or voting status quo. It was the court argument.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's the best you can do. Because, and this is after, you know, decades of, it didn't matter whether we had a majority, we, quote unquote, we had a majority or not. It's, we're just like holding our breath. And yeah, you protest outside the court, but it's like, it works properly when they are completely neutral. And they're also, on purpose, kept away from society so that they don't have these bias, you know, they don't have the biases of society working on them.
Yeah.
That's what makes it undemocratic. And it's like, we shouldn't even be arguing that, like, it, not to say it doesn't matter, but we want a world where it doesn't matter. And that's like, it's part of the demands. It's part of, and then the strategy is informed by the demands and the goals. And the goal is to not have these undemocratic institutions. It does turn our quote unquote great society, the Western civ, bulwark of Western civilization on its head, but that's exactly what being anti-racist is about.
Yeah.
Because these are the institutions that racists created. Why would we use them? How do you say they're not racist anymore? Not embodied with the structural intent of keeping the underprivileged out.
You can't.
And it's ruled against labor over and over and over again. When were labor rights ever secured by a Supreme Court decision? Never. It's always been through legislation. Now, of course, what do you do instead? Well, I know that there was ways where, why don't we review the constitutionality and how a law will be interpreted as it's being drafted? It's been usual practice that you pass laws and then you figure out how they actually work when it hits the ground.
Yeah.
This is messy. It's annoying. And people tune out because it's like, well, this was passed, but then what will it actually mean? Right. And then it becomes this long, drawn-out process of like, what does the new law mean for you? And it's already being challenged by its opponents. And then you don't know if it's still going to be affecting you right. or not. And then you can't plan. And then everything's inefficient and messy. And that's quote-unquote the messiness of democracy. But really, it's the messiness of bad governance.
Yeah.
Of government that, well, it's undemocratic and it doesn't just test the like, you could review the constitutionality of a law. Like, usually an office has to do that for itself. It has to hire its own person and its own lawyers to look it over and say, okay, this isn't counter to the constitution of the state or the country, but it could be challenged. So let's write this in this in so that it can fight off challenges. But it's like, it should be reviewed by everybody so it is challenge-proof by the time it's actually passed. That way, it is, in fact, something that represents a consensus, popular will, all the good stuff. Here's another thought about the last election and how I don't understand how liberals not actually learn anything. Like they said, in 2017, they were reassessing their strategies, and they've just done everything the same.
Yeah.
Reassessed.
How? What is different?
Nothing has been different. All the arguments are the same. All of the thinking. It's just like, instead of last time being the last chance to save democracy, now it's this chance.
Yeah.
It's always the last. It's always the most important election. They're a broken record. Okay, so here's from Steve Greenfield. He's a congressional candidate for the Green Party. Has for the last two. Yeah, you heard him speak for half an hour last week. We can share that video as well. But here is a Facebook post he made. It was in July, actually, so it was a while ago. But again, during the election cycle, he's been campaigning. They're around, and this is about the anti-war movement or the anti-war vote and how it's unrepresented at all, unless you're green. There were around 2 million people who did not vote for Hillary Clinton for leftist and anti-war, which is not leftist reasons. There were around 135 million who did not vote for her because they thought it wouldn't matter much which candidate won. It would have taken close to 100% of the 2 million with leftist and anti-war motivations voting for Clinton for Trump to have lost. It would only have taken 1.5% of the other 135 million. Nothing has changed about the map in 2020. If you're going on and on and on and on about leftists electing Trump and our purity and privilege and sanctimony, I'm not telling you to shut the hell up, although I would like it very much if you did, because that is hate speech. And for F's sake, at least have the dignity to own it when we label what you're doing McCarthyist. Yeah. If you were being strategic, you'd be devoting yourself with honey to the 1.5% of the 70 times larger group rather than pouring vinegar on 100% of the smaller one,
yeah.
Meaning leftist versus anti-war or, you know, voters. So please give some thought to why the corporate media and Democratic candidates and spokespeople barrage you with the gale force, fear, and loathing of Bernie Sanders and the Greens. It has nothing to do with how elections actually turn out.
I found a post, and it was someone saying that, in my opinion, Ted Cruz is the best person to take Ruth Bader Ginsburg's place on the Supreme Court.
Who is suggesting this?
Just some person in a group I'm in.
Oh, just a random.
It's not a real.
Is it a liberal group? Is it a...
It's
writing group.
This is a weird hill to die on. So
yeah.
It's
being taken from somewhere else.
Well, it's not. I would not say it's liberal. It's got a wide range of.
Well, people. Yeah, the group is just jokes about like the causes people have that are just really weird takes or just unique takes,
which
are always, you know, part of the greatness of life. So it brings us bits of joy.
But
to encounter them.
Cruz. Imagine Trump replacing
Justice Cruz.
Oh my God.
Well, let's see. What's the relationship like right now? Trump and Cruz.
The last I heard was the last I remember was right after 2016, after the primary, when I saw the video of Ted Cruz telling people to vote for the guy who called his wife ugly.
Right, yeah, yes. He was
that's the last
he was the guy who was brought low by Trump the most, right? That's right, he has the beard now. That was his transformation. So I keep confusing him.
But I do gotta say, the beard works for him.
Of course. Well, before he was a baby face, and now he's like Mr. Gruff. Well, when I hear Ted Cruz mentioned, it's usually as a joke of this is who the Democrats will put forward next term. The person to beat the actual fascist.
I remember.
Or just like the next hyper nationalist Republican.
I remember reading. Cure. It's like, it's 2028. And God, I hate to say it, but Trump is looking really good. The Republican nominee, Tom Cotton, is pretty terrifying. And we have to unite around Mitch McConnell, who has recently switched parties, in order to prevent the U.S. from sliding into fascism.
I have to wonder if Mitch McConnell will probably be too old. But certainly Cruz isn't, and other such senators, Republican or otherwise. Let's see, the observation from Chopper Trap House and others is that like the Democrats now or the Republican Party of the 90s. It's kind of not come first full circle, but this is like what they are like. They're now with Pence and other Republicans. I mean, Cuomo is basically like Pataki as far as policy goes. But just plus gay marriage and okay. No, he's still anti-pot. He's always like begrudgingly like holding it up.
Yeah.
So here's a piece from Ted Rall. Do you know of Ted Rall?
I do not know.
He's a comic. He's a political cartoonist.
Okay.
A very left. He's actually left wing.
Oh, awesome.
But yeah, but not like pro socialist, let's say, in his comics. But
okay.
But otherwise, very much anti-establishment.
All right. Okay. I'll take it.
So and that comes forward in his piece that he has wrote on his own site. The only wasted vote is a vote not for a third party. So we'll just start with the argument just for third party voting, and then we'll get deeper on with your with the other stuff. Oh, he's also written a book called Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Jesus, Ted. All you ever do, some people tell me, is complain. We get it. You hate both the Republicans and the Democrats. We don't like them either. But those are the only two parties that have a chance of winning an election. Stop telling us what not to do. Tell us what you think we should do instead. That criticism is fair. If you don't like something, it stands to reason you think something else should be better, and you ought to say what it is. In my defense, people will never build a new political system until the old one is dead to them. Che Guevara said that the masses would not risk the violent upheaval of revolution as long as they still believe the old regime capable of addressing their needs and grievances to any significant degree. For the most part, everyone who does not vote or does not plan to vote is a believer of that. Although the elimination of the two-party duopoly in the U.S. electoral politics does not necessitate violence, the same inertia principle applies. As long as progressives and other leftists continue to think that they can express their political will through the Dems, they won't create the space for what comes next. This is definitely my position. So, job one is to drive a stake through the corpse of the Dems. Much of my work these days is dedicated to my belief that the Dem Party is where progressivism and liberalism go to die. I am out to convince as many people as possible to get real, dump the Dems, and move on, articulating the platform of a new third party or revolutionary movement, or they could be one the same, before enough progressives and leftists has given up on the Dems, would put the cart before the horse. All right, articulating the platform of, say, a green left party or some revolutionary movement before enough people have given it up would be cart before the horse. I kind of disagree. I think we need to be there articulating this shit. So that people will be attracted to it, because a lot of people won't jump without there being another boat there.
Right.
Even if it's much, much smaller. And it can only take this many people at a time, but then we'll build a few more, it would also be arrogantly undemocratic. No one person, certainly not a 57-year-old cis white male political cartoonist, can or should write a program for the future of an entire society. Of course, a lot of other people have written these programs as well.
Right.
If you've been reading my work for a while, you know that I think that nothing short of revolution is adequate to address the radical problems faced by Americans and humanity, beginning with climate crisis. The profit imperative of capitalism is inherently corrupting, yada yada. We've covered this enough times if you're familiar with this program. The most compelling argument for electing Joe Biden and Kamala Harris is harm mitigation with a view toward preventing a second Donald Trump administration. Clearing up the mess with the last 4 years and governing better than Trump would have. I don't find this argument compelling. History shows that presidents rarely accomplish anything of substance during their second term. Trump would probably be the same. Not only did Barack Obama fail to clean up the mess he inherited from George Bush, he codified and expanded it. He told CIA torturers not to worry about being prosecuted. He expanded the assassination drone program. He sent more troops to Afghanistan and Iraq, and he continued Bush's policy of austerity. Likewise, Bill Clinton didn't do anything to reverse the Reagan Revolution. He went further right than Republicans dared with welfare reform. Joe Biden's devastating crime bill targeted at minority communities, NAFTA, and the WTO. Given Biden's half-century record of neoliberalism and his refusal to apologize for any of it and his crimes, it would be ridiculous to assume he would govern as anything other than a Republican. After you accept the reality that a Biden administration would probably be even worse than keeping Trump, and I have another piece that goes even deeper into that viewpoint. Should one vote? If so, for whom? There's been a long and honorable tradition of voter boycotts throughout the world. This is especially true in countries without vibrant, functioning democracies, like the U.S., though. Yeah, a two-party monopoly cannot possibly serve 330 million people.
No.
However, there is a relative dearth of data studying the motivations for people who stay home on election day. There is a cultural assumption in the U.S. that non-voters are lazy, apathetic, or both. So it's hard to ask intelligent progressives and other people disgusted with the two major parties to sit out on November 3rd, knowing that they will be shamed, which leaves the third party option. There are two relatively notable third party candidates. Clemson University professor Joe Jorgensen is the Libertarian Party nominee. On the left, Green Party standard bearer is unionist environmentalist Howie Hawkins. Given that neither candidate is likely to be elected, and they're both suffering from a media blackout, which is so total, is actually, if there's anything that disturbs me, Mike, it's the media blackout.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it occurred when Howie ran again for governor last 2 years ago. And I figure since the presidential election, maybe it wouldn't be so total, but it has been just as total. And that frightens the hell out of me. It was earlier in the year that I kind of thought optimistically that we would at least do as well as Jill Stein.
Yeah.
I'm not so confident in that assessment, especially since we have gotten less media coverage than she got, and she barely got some, but she at least got interviewed by CNN for an hour.
Yeah.
And you actually had all of the liberal media punditry commenting on her to convince everyone that she's crazy.
Yeah.
And whatnot. You know, now,
she was a hippie that could be discounted when Howie is a legitimate threat, I would say. I'd say that's what my opinion is, that the media sees Howie as more of a threat and doesn't want
He could convert him. More people. He could actually convince more people.
He's a labor. He's a union guy.
Yeah, and he's buff, and you know, he looks tough. Although he's not a fighter, obviously, but I mean, like, he looks like he could take someone. Yeah, maybe. I mean, they dropped the media landscape, the corporate media landscape dropped their guard a bit last term. That's kind of how I see it, where it's like, oh, sure, well, we'll give them some coverage. It'll probably only hurt Trump more or something. I don't know.
Right.
But they were so confident about Hillary's like clean sweep victory that they is like, we don't need to worry about the spoiler effect. Now, this is the reassessment. They did reassess. Their assessment was, and this is what Hillary said. That's right. We don't have to be confused. Their assessment was the left wing was too strong. The left wing was actually about expressing their political will, and they did, and that's what cost us the election. You know, Hillary said it was Jill Stein, the 1% that we got.
Of course.
And Bernie Sanders and the movement and they got people's dander up and they weren't submissive. And that's what they learned. And so it's like, we have to come hard. We have to make sure we nip. And the Bernie Sanders movement was weaker this time, or at least, it had more people involved.
Well,
and
the Bernie Sanders movement was split because Warren split the left vote.
And I find that like absurd from where I'm standing. I found that absurd. That's like, that's where maybe it was identity politics. But then there's an activist in Albany. Can't really say too much about him, but like he would make posts about how Castro was his guy. He loved Castro.
Julian Castro.
Yeah. You notice your face is like, wait, who's that guy again? He was the labor secretary of Obama. And he liked him as a second choice or a first choice. And then Warren was like his second. And Bernie was his third. And to the very end of the primary, or no, even after, like, oh, Castro or Warren should be the VP pick, you know, and still like posting about like that's what should be happening because they're so great and they're left or they're the progressive. Like, but I think they're seeing it as like these are the progressives that the status quo can handle.
Yeah.
Like they'll accept them. Bernie's too much and they won't accept. So that's a losing fight.
Well, Elizabeth Warren was the candidate for the progressive who read Harry Potter, and that was their theory. And they wanted to have Professor McGonagall / Hermione Granger to be the next president. And they thought that Elizabeth Warren would be that.
Yeah. She does have that energy, I guess. The energy of a fictional character. Fiction is important, but I don't get your political opinions from it. I think I tried doing that in high school, and I gave up on that pretty quick because I couldn't understand anything. I couldn't understand anything by just reading fiction.
Well, if I were to get my politics from Harry Potter, what I would get from it is, I need to start an underground cell. In order to violently
resist the administration.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That would be the lesson. Hey, form Dumbledore's army.
Yes.
That would be my takeaway from Harry Potter. But the liberals are like,
we need a secret base somewhere that's that can't be seen by drones.
Exactly. That sounds awesome.
Let's see. The wrap of this up from Ted Rall. Given that neither candidate is likely to be elected, the main reasons to cast a vote for Jorgensen or Hawkins or any minor party is to register a protest. I'm not apathetic. Look, I vote, and to build an organization for the future. You can't keep saying every 2 or 4 years, I would love to vote for a party other than Democrats or the Republicans, but the other parties are too small unless you actually do something to make one of those parties bigger. That means voting for them. That means contributing money. Not 2 years from now, not 4 years, now. For me, now was 2012. I have not decided whether to vote for Hawkins or someone else. This is where, like, we're all is like, whoa, come on, man. I do not know. I do know that I will not be voting for either big parties. I'm against both. Both parties kill innocent foreigners with abandon. Both parties neglect the poor. Neither party cares about the planet. Why should I vote for a party I disagree with on almost every fundamental issue? Another point is from a YouTuber, Hakim, who is a Iraqi Marxist.
Okay.
And he puts it this way. Both parties seem to love, both parties loved bombing my country. So there's no lesser evil for me. And that is, and that's kind of the difference I'm seeing, like what defines a liberal versus a leftist. And if you read those other articles from Forbes and whatever that say what the difference is, I think one thing that will be mentioned, and I've mentioned it last year, was the internationalism versus the nationalism. A liberal is still a nationalist.
Yeah.
They're still just thinking about American politics. If you think about international politics, neither party is different. They're both oppressing the world. They're both using the military as a cudgel for profit making. And for the world that's being bombed or occupied by our forces, it doesn't matter which party. It doesn't matter at all. And you notice that if you actually kind of look at wider policy besides just, say, your issue or the thing that you are attached to this week, which I empathize with, but otherwise, like. So next piece will be why leftists should vote green. Let's see, how long is this? Probably too long, actually. Can you read a few paragraphs from this one? It's from New Politics, written by Michael Hirsch. Why leftists in most states should vote green. Yep, so it's also one. Most states, so it is representing a safe state strategy too. And why in some states we shouldn't. So representing the safe state strategy. Oh, yeah. So focus on the first few paragraphs, and then we'll skip to the end.
My late comrade and esteemed New Politics editorial board member, Joanne Landy, steadfastly insisted she'd never vote for a Democratic Party candidate, preferring a protest vote for the Green Party. But I'll never join that party, she insisted. Hers was always a principled rejection of democratic betrayals, something revolutionaries and other dissidents are forced to do, if only as a last bleak resort. While she solidarized with the Greens' march-in-line rejection of any Democratic Party hopeful, no matter how progressive, itself what I considered to be the obverse of too many electorally fetishized DSA members whose hyper-regard for Democrats as the only game in town, no matter how degenerated the game, is unnerving. To Joanne's credit, she did aspire to see a mass working-class party emerge, but through the Greens, with their rampantly fractionalized inter-party life and ideo-fetishizing, would likely never cohere as a model anti-capitalist force.
So let me stop, because there's a lot to unpack in that paragraph. So first, there's the there's the line about that this revolutionary activist doesn't like the Greens because we stick by the principle that we are rejecting the Dems completely, no matter how progressive they run in the primary. If there's progressive candidate, even Democratic Socialists, we're still seeing that as entryism, and this is a fetish of some kind that we are being dogmatic. You know, we're not being open, and we're not, but you know, we're being stubborn. It's strange how, you know, when you're a left winger and you stand for principles, you're stubborn and sabotaging progressives.
Of course.
But when the right Dems or just establishment folks just abuse progressives, they're just like, well, we just got to stay with them. They're the ones feeding us crumbs. It's disheartening. Now, and then the other part is that, yeah, they won't join the Greens because they want to see a mass working party. They just don't believe the Greens, with our two factions, one of them not being anti-capitalist, will be that force.
Right.
So, like I mentioned in the last recorded episode, and maybe if, you know, depending on how things roll out this time, maybe some green left party that is at its core anti-capitalist. I mean, we passed a platform position now. It was last term in 2016. The Green Party platform is now post-capitalist, right? Okay. It doesn't have capitalist language anymore. It used to say, like, we're open-ended about it. Now we're like, no, we're building a post-capitalist economy. So it's still kind of, like, not socialist.
Right.
But it that was the compromise line of, like, we're a post-capitalist party.
Well, I joined the Greens because initially I was a Bernie guy, and after Bernie, I was like, well, I think we need a new left party. I was hesitant on the Greens at first, but I eventually realized that, yeah, this is the best chance that the left has for, like, a unified party.
And yeah, so it's weird that all of these more, say, older revolutionary activists would see it as, like, it's not a chance.
Right.
And so they'd always, like, they'd vote for Green candidates when they were able to run. But that's so few and far between and rare because it doesn't have the support of such activists. Like, right. She should be running as a Green at this point. So anyway, keep going with the next paragraph. From the writer's perspective, too.
To the party's credit, its 2020 electoral platform reads well enough, anticipating much of what a socialist movement would advocate. For Green presidential candidate Howie Hawkins' view of Green possibilities, see his book. I was never quite as dismissive of the Democrats' tote court as was Joanne, let alone Hawkins. But I always agreed that in my home state of New York, the Democrats didn't need nor deserve backing from any left militant, let alone the bulk of union voters repaid so shabbily by party elects from the grasping Andrew Cuomo on down. So I repeatedly vote Green. To and enthusiastically so for Howie Hawkins, a trade union militant, an acknowledged socialist representing the best of the working class left. The down ticket often isn't so uniformly impressive, though. One pro forma hopeful running for state assembly in my district some years back couldn't explain, when interviewed on local TV, what an assembly member did or should do. A low moment in the class struggle, surely, but no reflection on Hawkins, then the top of the state ticket, and this year's presidential insurgent. This coming November 3rd, voters face the likelihood of a nationwide contest between two major party troll candidates that a benign house pet would not cotton to, no matter the blathering of cable news punditry, pro or con. Donald Trump is the worst racist thug.
We can probably skip ahead since everyone probably already knows what the next paragraph says. Both candidates are bad. One's racist thug, and Biden is this and that. So let's end. He's passive.
And then there's the Biden, skip ahead where to, he's a neoliberal stalking horse.
Yeah, yep, Biden's. That's about right.
Oh, yeah. Why voting Green in safe states matters. The Greens are likely not a palpable or viable alternative to the two-party duopoly. I disagree with that.
Does he say why? I don't think he does. No, he doesn't.
But a vote for them anyways is necessary in the lead-up to November 3rd. In the many states stagely predicted now to go for either Trump or Biden, hands down.
But you're depending on, like, predictions made by hack pundits or data gatherers that are gathering based on their biased assumptions, or they're calling just, you know, prime voters
in that majority of non-swing states, 36 at last count, in which Biden or Trump can be safely predicted to cinch. The left should tout the Greens, including not just boosting them largely as an electoral adjunct to the brilliant mass movement in the streets to defund the ill-serving, misplaced police. the healthiest extra parliamentary effort since Occupy, but as a win-win that can potentially challenge the Democrats programmatically and in actuality, picking up on Bernie's pre-collapse effort. Would that be possible? I think yes, because there is every reason to break with the Democrats, but not everywhere just now.
So that's leaving people in Ohio basically to like eat shit.
Yeah.
I don't like that at all.
I don't like it either.
I don't like telling people that. I'd rather we be united. We're a united country, right?
Yeah.
So why say like this, the swing states of the country, which like they should break off somehow, you know? Or we organize them last. I mean, and this is all just going back to the fact that we did safe state strategy in 04 because the liberal half of the party believed in spoiler effect and it blew up in our face. Yeah. It was a disaster. And it also didn't help the Democrats win. This is an exact repetition of 04. That's the way I'm seeing it. Sorry, go on.
In only a minority of states will a Biden vote by leftists matter and need to be called for. An effort by any socialists for Biden is defensible and necessary in defeating Trump only in the 14 battleground states at present, as demarcated by the Cook Political Report for late July, showing four states, Arizona, Georgia, Maine, and 2nd CD and North Carolina as toss-ups, seven leading Democratic, Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, Nebraska, 2nd CD, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and three leaning Republican, Iowa, Ohio, and Texas, of which there may reasonably be fewer in the weeks leading up to the general election on November 3rd.
So, like, deciding where you, like, how you go to vote and what, like, it's up to, like, you have to watch, like, the polls every week. It's so agonizing.
Yeah.
And not to mention, so, like, the 36 safe states are also the states that were actually on the ballot.
Yeah.
Because the Democrats have worked very tirelessly to kick us off the ballot in any of the states they were leaning towards, particularly Pennsylvania and Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And they were undemocratic nature, you know, mask off. It's just true colors, you know. When you actually oppose the status quo, the true colors come out. Other we're protecting democracy. Yeah, right.
Of course, it's too early to know the outcome. Closer to the election, we will see if any others emerge as toss-ups, if the 14 remain close, or if more collapse for one or the other sad, bad, dangerous to no candidate. It's only in that minority of states that the pro-Biden argument holds water, and where a vote for the Greens over Biden would prove mischievous at best and to many allies
traitorous at worst. So this is like that really like kind of the, this is where even I would hem and haw about, like,
yeah.
I have my position, but it pisses a lot of potential allies off because you're not doing what they're doing and right. You're not voting team establishment.
Yeah.
And you're not, you know, it's like you're portraying them. And this is represented like this. There's a political cartoonist that's way more radical. He's called Black and Red Salamander.
Okay.
And half of his content, which is my only complaint about him, he's otherwise like, this is like where, like, if an anarcho-syndicalist would be represented in the papers or in the political cartoon pages,
ooh,
like this guy's work would be there. And it's very sharp too. But some of his, like, part of his, like, a third of his content is bashing other lefties.
Oh.
Particularly like this straw man lefty that he has of like the armchair revolutionary,
yep,
or the accelerationist. And he has the mind of, like, if we're not voting for Biden, there are all of these moderate liberals or progressives who are not going to join our cause because we didn't vote for Biden before. And I was making a comment he has, and he was arguing with someone else in his comments about that it really doesn't matter either way. Like, people are either going to move left or they're not.
Yeah.
And it's not really what we're doing that's going to, our positions, our platforms, and the organization we have will draw them. But it's not like what we did in the past, or did we vote like they did? Because, I mean, if they're going to change their mind, they're going to view the past self of them as mistaken.
Right.
They have to realize they're making a mistake. Otherwise, we're agreeing with them that voting for quote unquote harm reduction, which it isn't. Harm reduction is safe ejection sites and homes housing.
Yeah.
It isn't voting for war. We're voting for the status quo.
Yeah.
Let's see. Just to wrap up this, is there any like see the DSA, to its credit, is amicably working on both sides of the fence. Though that may be more of a reflection of a few fractional body blows and contending egos than a healthy respect for differences, though that could change given how difficult it is for comrades to socialize absent in person. And, you know, just kind of bottom line, the larger a vote for the Greens equates with more pressure that can be put on a post-Biden post-victory, which, of course, then plays into the we can push Biden left after the election.
But can't
did that happen with Obama? Did that happen with Obama? Was he pushed left on anything? Absolutely not.
No, Obama,
he was pushed right after the election.
Obama was the left that was pushing.
Exactly. And that's the hollowness of that position. I don't do they believe that? Maybe it's just like they don't know what else to believe. I mean, it's the worldview. It would all come crashing down if they you know, like the person who says that if they didn't believe in God, they'd go out murdering people.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, if I don't believe that I can work parliament in a parliamentary way, I'd have to accept that I might have to hurt somebody someday because political power is violence. Or it's saying it's sticking your ground and saying, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to punch me? Are you going to do something to move me? That's a demand given to every police line when you're protesting. It's the demand that you need to give Mitch McConnell when you are opposing whatever agenda you think he actually has, or the corporate agenda, which of course is not actually opposed by the Dems.
No.
So this kind of hemming and hawing, trying to have both sides, it frustrates me a bit, and it's represented by the next article, which I haven't been able to load, but it was basically, if we have, oh yeah, and also he kind of mentions that, like, you know, the Green Party is not developed, you know, this time, and that's why it's not the place to vote everywhere. I'm like, well, why isn't it developed everywhere?
Because we're not voting everywhere. No, we're not voting everywhere yet.
They're not getting support everywhere.
We need more support.
By people like you, and so on. And so it's always kind of a circular argument at the end of the day. The other one is then the even more nuanced strategy of safe states, but if you're depending on the chances of Biden, like the leaning and the stats, of rolling a dice.
Oh yeah.
And if it's more than say, if you can load it, you can.
I got it.
Okay, read it out. It's not that long.
Unless you voted for Bernie or Warren in the primaries. You are disappointed at how little influence they had on the party platform, but you would much rather have Joe Biden than another 4 years of Trump. Maybe you have considered voting for Green Party nominee Howie Hawkins, who shares many of the same views as Bernie, but you are probably afraid of splitting the left-leaning vote. You are not alone.
Because we're so big, you know.
By voting strategically, progressives can give the Green Party 9 million votes, 8% of the popular vote, without giving Trump the slightest advantage of in swing or blue states. Here's how.
It's all very abstract.
The math. We start with a required winning margin of 5%, meaning Biden should get at least 55% of the votes that went to major parties before we start giving votes to third parties. This margin would give Biden a guaranteed win in each state. Red states like Kentucky, Louisiana are states where Trump won more than 55% of the major party votes in 2016. They are not going to flip Democratic. There, it is safe to vote Green without affecting the outcome. Swing states like New Hampshire and Michigan are states where the margin of victory in 2016 was less than 5%. There, it is critical to vote Democratic because every single vote counts to defeat Trump. For the blue states, some additional math is necessary. All of it is verifiable with public data. Totals for the 2016 election are from the Federal Election Commission website. Data for the 2020 primaries is from NBC News. We assume that Bernie and Warren voters in the 2020 primary match the overall fraction of progressive voters among Democrats in each state. I'd say that's a stretch, but good enough. Mm. If all progressive refused to vote for Biden, some blue states, such as Washington and Vermont, would actually flip Republican. Others would become toss-ups. Still others, like New York and Hawaii, would still be safely blue.
That's the thing about like Green Party strategy with the liberals in the party, which are, I could call them progressives as well.
Yeah.
They're not socialists, but they're anti-war.
Yeah.
And they kind of always want our messaging and optics to gear towards bringing over that progressive bloc, which actually does have voting power. Of a type. And I also find it interesting that like the way he's coming at this is like, how can the Greens actually not affect the outcome while maximizing our votes?
Yeah.
Which is interesting in that, like, so Howie's take in his argument of voting everywhere, because everywhere is a battleground, is that we do want to have an effect on the elections. If we cost the Dems a state, their assessment should have been we needed to go left.
Right.
Not we need to crush the Greens this time. Which, of course, like, you're kind of, it's the argument that assumes that our opponents have consciences and they do want to be better and they do want to attract votes. But of course, they don't have to attract votes. They can just suppress the vote. They can suppress parties like ours, which is the road they've taken.
Take California, for example. We want a 55% win for Biden. Clinton won by 66% in 2016, only counting major parties. Meaning Trump got 36%. Biden only needs 42% of these voters to maintain a 55% lead. The other 24% don't matter. Their fraction of the Democrats is 24 to 66, 37%. 49% of California Democrats voted for a progressive candidate in 2020. Therefore, math, 76% of California progressives can vote third party without turning their state into a toss-up. Each California progressive can give themselves a 76% chance of voting third party by rolling 2 6-sided dice and voting for Biden if the sum is 5.
It's like
or
a D&D
less.
Campaign.
Yeah.
Yes. Let's play some D&D.
Politics
with our
politics. Is D&D.
Yes. Roll for charisma. Your candidate made a
whoopsie.
Made a gaffe. Yeah. So it's like literally leave your vote up to chance. And so that irks me. But I get like everything else that this guy's like saying, right?
Like I get from like my bachelor's is in physics. I'm a math guy and I like this. I kind of like
it. Makes
the math
sense.
It
it's
does
rational.
Make sense.
It's ignoring the actual people involved and their actual feelings,
right? Exactly.
And their motivations. It's all just like. But this is where like you take those things out by having organizational discipline of like. So I was telling you like before we started that if we had like a party that were like a green left party and where like we gave out the order of like to maximize our vote total if you're in this state. But we don't want to help like the fascists, we, you know, to learn from mistakes of, you know, the 1930s, then we can, you roll the dice and do that.
Right.
Right. But everyone has to do it. That's how you actually get these numbers to make sense.
Right.
Everyone, literally everyone available has to do it. And when it comes,
like this has to be doctrine among all the progressives.
If you've ever done real voter outreach or get out the vote. You know that is all abstracted nonsense.
Oh, definitely.
If there are 100 voters registered and you door knock and you actually interact with all of them and give them the date and the info to vote, you give them reasons to vote, you talk to them and they're like receptive and they're on board, half of them will actually actually vote or some proportion. And that's you scale that up to the whole country and It's a big mess when it comes to it. And that's kind of why these whole big elections where it's all at once and it's just not the way we should be doing things. It should really be like small elections up. But even if it's in a locality, again, getting like a neighborhood, a block to come out and do one thing. Because we're all thinking individually, I suppose, you know, and that's where the discipline comes in of like you will do. Okay, so we got to cut off the hour now, and we've said everything we need to say about that. I think. Well, we can pick it up.
Well,
also,
it's basically just says the same, but gives different ways of finding the proportion for different states.
Oh, come all ye citizens and hear my tale of woe, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. How I ruined the country with my choice 5 years ago, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Twin Towers fell and 3,000 died, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The terrorists came and there was no place to hide, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Democrats voted to bomb Afghanistan, to cut back freedoms once enjoyed across the land. The party of Jefferson afraid to take a stand, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. W set his sights on Saddam in Iraq, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The Democrats gave the okay to attack, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The president said he'd wage eternal war, and the Democrats nodded from the Senate floor, and all the while the money dried up for the poor, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. Now color-coded warnings invade our every thought, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. Duct tape and plastic are all that we've got, all because I voted for Ralph Nader. The fires will rage throughout the Middle East, the terrorist threat will continue to increase, and war will go on, there never will be peace, all because I voted for Ralph Nader.
Hey, welcome back to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, with
Michael Walsh. Hello.
Hey, welcome back. Now, I just wanted to mention, do a little story time. So I went to the Cape Cod for my kind of late summer vacation, which I only do one a year. And I biked around. I biked like 40 miles. So my legs are destroyed. But otherwise, I had a good conversation, hour and a half, with the local used bookstore owner, Craig of Craig's Books. So I guess a shout out to him. Now that I've said his name, I suppose I won't say anything derogatory. But he was a Randian. An objectivist.
Okay.
But also apolitical in tone that he wasn't participating in the election. Because he was talking, like, the conversation started with him talking to someone else about his predictions of, like, even when there's a vaccine, you know, and also it's not over because the vaccine is, a vaccine's never completely a complete coverage.
Right.
It's not complete safe. There's no such thing as complete safety. But so, like, things will be continuing in perpetuity, and not to mention that even the Black Death and stuff, it came back every 10 years. We might have such a superbug every 10 years. Think about that in the future, okay? Then,
yay.
But anyway, yeah, the conversation has twists and turns, mostly about, like, how he felt miffed by local government, and that, like, he just wants to, as he put it, you know, his philosophy, and this is a lot of Americans, I'm sure, libertarian leaning or whatever, liberals. Yeah. I just want to follow the rules and be able to earn a living and do some of it what I want and be peace and live in peace. And but I kind of want to draw out the contradiction in my kind of interview style conversation with him, because I want to learn more, and he was plenty, you know, free to talk. That, like, what was standing in his way were the rules. So, like, well, you say you want to follow rules, right? And but the it matters who makes the rules. And if the rules are these curmudgeon old-timers who don't want you to put your sign up on the side of the building or let things slide when it came to following the building codes for your grandma's old house that's basically on one of the main roads.
Yeah.
But the sewer system is so limited in those areas that, like, you gotta upgrade the septic system.
Yeah.
I don't even have this vocabulary because I'm such a city boy. And so, like, you know, he was, you know, confident that he would double his earnings if he had a different, all these things went his way. But they didn't, because he didn't seem to care about other people's opinions or what makes him tick. And I just kind of kept, like, well, you know why this guy was so mad at you, or, you know. And it kind of, like, it was both, like, he didn't want to kiss the ring, or, like, people please, but it's like, well, but he also kind of put in terms of like, I didn't impress the board members or the town board or the town government in my plans. And it's like, well, maybe they would have sided with you if you did impress them. Like, yeah. What effort did you put in? These are questions. These are simple questions. Maybe they don't. Maybe it's the same as like blaming someone for their poverty. Like, well, maybe you just didn't try hard enough. Of course, that's not what I'm suggesting. I was very empathetic. But I was trying to tease out like what was really at work. And because if you just have that, the objectivist viewpoint of like, you can, it's almost you can't know anything, but it's like you got to know something. Right. And what you know is that like people could just be selfish and that works out. Anyway, so I wanted something that we did the Supreme Court thing instead of this one first, but it was about back in June, story from Politico.
Okay.
About title is Progressive Steamrolled Across the Senate Map. So this is something to take into account when it comes to pressing Biden left, or just how ridiculous I think that position or viewpoint is. What do you think the Senate makeup is going to be? It's going to be the same as when, say, like if there was a Dem majority, it's going to be the same as 08. There's no progressive legislation will be passed, and what progressive champions that exist will be drowned out, run out, primaried every term, and or like say Anthony Weiner, they're going to like come upon some tragedy or a surprise scandal will occur. Same with Spitzer, you know, like everyone has their faults, everyone has their, you know, like some potential scandal, especially if they're a real human being who isn't some robot or monster lizard person. But here's what the entry is like. This was to me, because this is not the first time this has happened. This also happened in 2014 and other times where like, oh, we're just primary, all these progressive Dems, the justice Dems, democratic socialists even, they'll run in Dem primaries and some will win and we'll build up our base there. And then we can really affect them. But to me, this is the reality I see. Progressive steamroll. Left-wing candidates have been shut out of the Democratic Senate primaries thus far in 2020. This is back in June. There haven't been too many primaries since then.
No.
So this is filed by Alex Thompson and James Arkin. What great, upstanding white names. If Democrats win back the Senate this fall, don't expect a rush to pass the Green New Deal. This is the watered-down one. Or Medicare for All. The left wing has been wiped out in Senate primaries or failed to recruit at all in states across the map this year. So they're kind of in the same position as the Greens as well,
which is
for all the bluster of the Bernie and progressive movement that they're so much stronger than us with their entryism. I'm like, you know, you don't look that much stronger than us.
Yeah.
I mean, we elect 1,000 people over 10 years. So do you. And maybe they're in higher offices, but I mean, when it comes to the votes and the drafting of and the committee seats, they're powerless. Liberal insurgents on the ballot over the coming weeks in states like Kentucky and Colorado aren't favored to fare any better, failing to gain significant traction thus far against more moderate favorites. And by favorites, they mean capitalist favorites. Because when it comes to who has support when in Politico and other like, you know, wall posts and whatever, it's who's raising the money. Like, they think Biden's ahead of Trump because he has more billionaire support.
Yeah.
A Senate shutout would be an embarrassment for the progressive movement, which a few months ago looked ascendant. If Biden wins the presidency and Democrats take back the Senate, so that just shows how precarious their momentum was, it would likely result in a more incremental approach to legislating, despite Biden's public overtures to the left since clinching the nomination. The failure of left-wing candidates in their primaries has prompted soul searching among many progressive leaders, so they have to reassess now, who now believe that they neglected the task of organizing and building a down ballot bench as they were caught in the thrall of Sanders' candidacy. So it can't be top down.
No.
It is also a victory for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who recruited most of the primary victors, viewing them as more likely to win general elections because they have Wall Street finance sector money behind them. And a lot of these people he's picked, they're alumni of the intelligence sector and the military. So, Junta, we have seen that the left doesn't really, I guess I'm quoting him now. No, this is even Weber. We have seen that the left doesn't really have the coordinated infrastructure to compete on a statewide level, acknowledged Evan Weber, co-founder and political director of the Sunrise Movement, which is backing underdog candidates in Senate primaries this month in Kentucky and Colorado. Now, Steve Greenfield has acknowledged, or he's kind of done his interviewing of Sunrise Movement people, that they are just Democratic Party apparatchiks, that they just suddenly appeared, you know, taking advantage of the situation to have AOC as their kind of to boost them.
Yeah.
To boost the watered down Green New Deal. And they brought a lot of progressives on board as like, oh, we got a victory. We got this into the public consciousness, sort of. Schumer works really hard to get a candidate and then effectively pushes others to coalesce behind them. You know, party, loyalty, and discipline. Co-founder of progressive think tank Data for Progress. Christina Ramirez, an activist who made her first run for office this year, narrowly lost Texas's Senate primary in March, running on a more liberal platform. She missed the second spot in a runoff by 27,000 votes after receiving little investment from national organizations. So it shows you, like, Bernie shows you can mass fundraise. But that's only if it's the whole country and if it's Sanders.
Yeah.
If it was someone down ballot, maybe they'd get a little tribble.
Right.
But it's not a strategy. Do paying membership like a union. Unions always have money. Unfortunately, they've given it to Democrats over the last 40 years. But discipline, and like, and it's the law, you know, or it's required. That's the thing. It's a requirement. Oppressing their membership by having them pay $7 every paycheck. I never complained about doing such a thing. No progressive is going to be at the top of the ticket in general if we don't have a slugout all fight in the primary, she said. We need to be willing to have those fights in the primary and fight harder than we did, I think, in 2020. So she's basically saying we're going to do it all over again. In addition, the Senate races, progressives have also come up short against many of the incumbent House Dems they've targeted. And that's the thing, when you're like a professional organizer slash like someone like Ramirez here, where like you're looking at things from the top down, like,
right,
how are you going to recruit these local people? That only happens in localities.
Yeah.
You have to build like our revolution chapters in every little locality. And that is the work of a decade,
yeah,
not a cycle. Still, some take heart that at least many of the candidates in swing states are more liberal than their counterparts just a decade ago. Okay. Every Senate candidate, see, they're not anti-war, but they're more liberal in other ways. Are they more liberal in that they are pro-choice? Let's see. Mary Kelly in Arizona and Cal Cunningham in North Carolina support public option to compete with private health. This is the progressive victory. This is what all the entryism really is about. This is what it comes down to at the end of the day. You get a few candidates who say they were for a public option. Oh, wow. Anyway, even if Democrats win control of the chamber, and this is like a decade ago that was on the table, party strategists argue the recruited candidates have won or opposed to win because of their fundraising power, in-state political network, meaning political machines, and voters' desire to take back the candidate seen most likely to unseat incumbent Republicans, which means someone just like them.
Yeah.
But with a D. Lists a bunch of other blue dogs. Democrats are laser focused on flipping the Senate because that's all that matters, right? Whatever policy results don't matter. Ending Mitch McConnell's majority, which is why we're seeing tremendous, even if you do everything the same way. So on and so on. Standard Politico article. So lots to rant about. I believe I have the best chance to beat Cory Gardner, I said. I think Hickenlooper is going to struggle to explain why voters should hire him for a job he said he didn't want and would be terrible at. This is Andrew Romanoff, who is running to Hickenlooper's left, called the June 30th Colorado primary one of the last beachheads for progressives in the country. Kentucky State Rep. Charles Booker, a black first-term rep from Louisville, has seen some momentum behind his primary campaign this week amid protests over police brutality in the state. He raised more than $300,000 in 5 days, according to his campaign, similar to his haul for the entire first quarter this year, where $100,000 is a lot of money. Betsy Sweet, a liberal candidate in Maine's Senate race, who was endorsed by Justice Democrats, but is being dramatically outspent by Gideon, acknowledged the tough odds. And this is the race that Lisa Savage is in, by the way. They're not mentioning her at all.
Yeah.
That's what media blackout means.
Yeah.
That, like, they can mention progressives and that they're the left. There's no one left of that. And they're the underdogs that, like, they're only raising $100 Fasten dollars.
Oh, God.
What losers. I think it leaves a bigger lane open for us progressives who are left, said Sweet. That said, I think progressive orgs are reluctant to take a stand, and it's really hard. Stand on what? Left-leaning groups in the party aren't always at odds. Democracy for America has endorsed candidates ranging from Sweet in Maine to Teresa Greenfield, the National Party's pick who won the Iowa primary last week. So I guess they're, you know, nice to capitalists. In a state where progressives should win, we support strongly progressives to win, she said. Some of these seats we know are going to be more... See, like, if they're going to win, then we'll support them. So it's really not about the policy of the progressiveness.
Right.
Thing. It's just about winning. It's about flipping the Senate, because that the milk and honey will flow. The honey and apples will truly have a blessed year. Shana tova. It's important not to ignore national politics, and we need to do a better job at fielding supporting candidates further down the ballot. Isn't it funny that all of these progressives would say to us Greens that we shouldn't be running for president in higher offices, we need to focus on the localities, and then when they do their entryism, it's exactly what they do?
Yeah. It is.
So there's that uppity piece right there. I just wanted to, like, I see the entryism path as, if not more depressing than at least being able to, like, not have to kowtow with these big money groups.
One of the co-hosts needs to blow his nose.
His big Jewish schnauzer. Did you see the meme of from Barbra Streisand? Of, oh, no. Like, if I can fit a mask over my nose, so can you.
It's too funny.
Okay.
I shared a really good one, and it was a picture of some hunter wearing full camo stuff, and it's like, if you can wear this covered in deer piss for 3 hours, then you can wear a mask.
quite specific there.
Yeah.
So I'll just summarize this one, but it's basically from Slate saying that in European elections, Greens have been gaining ground.
Yeah.
Because the major parties, whether they actually be called socialist or not, which some of them are the establishment, and everyone's upset with them for good reasons. And the Greens are still an alternative. They've been parliamentary parties working with the, you know, establishment in some capacity. So they're not like super radical, but they have the climate change messaging, and that's kind of what this puts across by Joshua Keating. So I won't go, it was very short, but it's like, let's see, in Austria, in France, you know, Germany, the Green Party is the oldest in Germany.
Yeah.
But they saw unprecedented success in European Parliament elections last year. It was clear that voters are responding to concerns about the climate crisis, as well as a loss of confidence in the big mainstream parties. Judging from recent election results, the infatuation hasn't faded. These are more local elections. In several countries, the Greens appear on the verge of eclipsing old-school socialist, meaning ones that have, like, labor parties like the Dems, or social democratic parties as the main electoral voice of the left. Okay, so these are lefties actually voting for a more left-wing party. No, though in Germany, there is parties further left than the Greens. There's Die Linke, which literally means the left. Other countries, other parliamentary countries, they have a left-green party, which is a fusion of the two, where the Greens are like the less radical wing. They're the right wing of the left party. And that's kind of what, if we were all the fused together, that's what would occur. Ideally, if all the progressives kind of joined, they would definitely outvote or outvoice any socialists, and so all the socialists would probably leave,
yeah.
Like me. And that's the thing. Like, I want them all to join, but once they do, the fear is like the Greens become an entryist party, but that's why they won't join. So, because we won't do any entryism. Next is more tongue-in-cheek from World Socialist website. These guys are nutters, but they're kind of fun because they blast everyone, including us. And this one's about the movement for a People's Party. And like my first, like, you know, this is, I'm not taking this. So it's like, the title is No Program, No Principles, No Future. And my reason for not taking it very seriously is that they say they're going to do what the Green Party has done over 20 years in one election cycle. There seems to be a misunderstanding of just how hard it is to keep ballot access and to get it in the first place, and to seed local organizations. They're talking about it like it's as simple as baking a pie, and it's not. So I'm going to go ahead with that.
Okay.
On August 30th, the Movement for People's Party held its inaugural online People's Convention, which ended with participants voting to create, quoting them, a major new People's Party free of corporate money and influence. In 2021, the MPP's stated purpose is to be a mechanism for candidates to run outside of the Democratic Party, all for that, with the goal of achieving ballot status to run congressional candidates in 2022 and then the 2024 presidential election. Now, the Greens already act as this mechanism. This is what they are to me. All other socialist or radical movements, BLM included, aside, the very least, were a mechanism to run outside the Dems.
Yeah.
To me, whether internal politics we actually have in the Green Party, that's at least like what we are. And so it's always kind of like, why don't they just run as Greens? And I think I've covered this before. They say like brand issues, mostly because they have been indoctrinated by Democratic Party propaganda about us being spoilers or that we're not the right party. So it's like, so the former article from last hour was from like a militant leftist saying like the Greens are not militant enough. And then you'll have progressives that will say we're too militant.
Yeah, which one is it?
Well, it depends on where you're currently standing, you know. And so like we can never satisfy everyone, and but it's like their organizations are just as much failing as ours are. So then it just becomes everyone's failing together, and so it's, since everyone's kind of doing poorly because we're all not in one thing,
right?
Then it's like we won't join someone else because they're not doing any better. Like someone has to do better than all the other options. Now, right. I think my point of view is that the Greens being independent are better just in the abstract. So I think I was working off of that line of thinking. So like what's abstractly better first, and then we can talk about results. Others just focus on results and not like what principles are being followed.
Right.
The MPP is an example of the type of, so this one pulls no punches. These guys, like I said, they're nutters for the most part, but like they're fun to read.
Okay.
So the MPP is an example of the type of formation produced by an extremely low level political consciousness. It is somewhat difficult to comment on because it is not a serious organization. The term party is purely nominal. A party is based on a common program. And this is like pointed out that they were voted on to form a party by the participants of the live stream.
Right.
So there was no, from what I could tell, any barrier to entry to participating.
Huh.
And this means like, so it's meaningless to me.
Yeah.
It's not based on any common program or assessment of experience or any common perspective. The MPP has none of these things. It does not understand the past. It has nothing to offer to the present, and it has no future. Now, this is talking about the MMP, but it could be talking about all sorts of things.
Right.
So I like the linguistics of it. What predominated among the eclectic combination of individuals, celebrities, and media personalities brought together on August 30th was unseriousness, pessimism, and a fair amount of dishonesty. The dominant line, however, was provided by those in or around the Democratic Party, which seems like a contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
The convention was organized by Mick Braga, who worked with Democratic Governor Virginia Terry McAuliffe and Democratic Senator John Kerry before becoming the National Political Outreach Coordinator for the Sanders campaign last term.
Oh.
And a founding member of the Sanders-affiliated Our Revolution. Brana formed the MPP in 2017 out of the Draft Bernie for a People's Party org after Sanders endorsed Clinton in the 2016 elections. So he's like jumping. He's like, okay, we're not going to do that, so we'll do something else. And then we'll do something else. And then we'll do something else. Always his own thing. Always his own org. Not like, and then he'll reach out to work with other people. But never people to his left. At the time, Brana launched a fundraising campaign to entreat Sanders to head the People's Party, which Sanders did not even bother to acknowledge, just as he does not acknowledge the Greens. Other participants include Nina Turner, a national co-chair of Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, former Democratic Party presidential candidate Marianne Williamson, professor and DSA member Cornel West, fired Amazon worker and activist Chris Smalls, comedians Jimmy Dore, Graham Elwood, Ron McClone. LaRon also did a Green Party event with us. Actor and DSA member Danny Glover, and former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, as well as investigative journalist Chris Hedges. Many of these participating in the conference advocate a vote for Biden in the 2020 elections. This includes the three main concluding speakers, Marianne Williamson, Cornel West, and Nina Turner. West cited approvingly Professor Noam Chomsky and Angela Davis, stating that he understood a vote for Biden was part of the development of an anti-fascist coalition. I just have a hard time treating Biden and the Biden supporters as anti-fascists.
Yeah.
Because they don't speak like anti-fascists.
No. Nope.
They don't act like anti-fascists. They actually seem okay with it as long as it's their team doing it.
Right.
Turner, a member of the Democratic Party National Convention Committee just this year. So she's just right, you know, switching, so to speak, but is she really? Expressed the basic political orientation of this People's Party when she said prior to the event that there are some progressives who want to Dem exit, but there are some progressives who believe that it's their party and they can cry if they want to, and I'm going to stay inside and push. These two perspectives are parallel and the end is the same, she said. In these words, both those who are participating in this new venture, as well as those committed to staying in the Dem party, share the same strategy and perspective. So this is like my clue that they're not serious about being independent. So are you really going to be the mechanism to run outside the Democratic Party when you say, like, we're just pushing from the, like, this is them. This is the strategy of pushing from the outside.
Right.
But we're still like on the side of pushing.
Right.
Not doing our own thing.
Yeah.
Then there was Ventura, whose presence expressed the unprincipled and unserious character of the whole operation. Brana introduced Ventura with a glowing tribute, referring to him as a very special guest, wearing a polo shirt with the insignia of the Navy SEALs displayed on his chest. Ventura proudly proclaimed himself a fiscal conservative. That is, that he is in favor of social cuts to social programs. No one participating considered it necessary to distinguish themselves from this right-wing agenda. The former Minnesota governor combines both anti-war positions with far-right and libertarian ones. He appeared on the fascistic Alex Jones program to call for a vote for Texas Congressman Ron Paul during the 2012 presidential primaries. Anyone with principles would have had to immediately disassociate with him based on his presence alone. This is coming from very hard-headed socialists. Journalist Chris Hedges denounced more stridently than the rest both the Dems and Republicans. He's more like the Ted Rall type, declaring that a vote for Biden was a vote for war, austerity, and reaction. Hedges was also the only speaker to directly criticize Sanders, calling him a dutiful sheepdog and channeling opposition behind Clinton and Biden in both in the last cycles. He did not remark on the fact that the speakers and organizers of the event were among those assisting the sheepdog, nor that many of the people speaking with him were urging a vote for Biden. So he was mostly there to just propagate his own message and have the soapbox. Otherwise, he's a Green Party supporter, as this says. These moral condemnations, however, in the end amounted to very little. Hedges concluded that a demoralized declaration that the fight against fascism was futile and doomed to defeat. because he knows his history and he has seen enough disasters to know what happens.
Yeah.
So we kind of need to be preparing for the worst because the best can work itself out. Jewish proverb.
Yep.
He also called for a vote for the Green Party. Capitalist, and this is where, again, I think they're nutters. They call us a capitalist party that serves as an external pressure group on the Dems. Now, this is something that Hawkins mentioned in an interview once. And so they just glop onto that. And they're Hawkins isn't really a socialist. He mentioned that how, like, you know, if we help the Dems lose, that will push them to the left. So it's like, that's all the Greens are good for. That's what they do. That's what Hawkins said the Greens do. Like, that's one of the 10 things he says the Greens do. So anyway, they just so this is very selective facts. And that's why I'm trying to give more facts as I go. More perspectives, because reading this alone would just be like,
right.
Looking at, have you seen the meme where it's like someone, it's a girl who's posing, and then the camera is just on her chest,
right?
Yeah, it's like that.
I've
for the money.
I've used that meme template many a times.
Yeah. No, I just used it one where it's the because Maddow and the media establishment, they're calling the Greens scammers. We're scammers, Mike.
How? What are we doing?
We're trying to scam the American people by presenting a left alternative that helps Russia.
In
Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So when we are stricken from the ballot, that is we're a scam that is getting its just reward. Justice is being served.
Funny story. I've actually messaged one of Russia's media outlets on Facebook saying, "Hey, I make memes. I hear you're trying to destabilize the country. Will you pay me money to make memes?" They never got back to me.
Oh. But like, you got to go under the table. You're not going to the right people. These mysterious people.
If the mysterious people are somehow funding this, I might as well try to get my money's worth out of it.
Mike, that's because we're the useful idiots. Right. We're not the supervillains. We're the ones that are doing their bidding without knowing it.
Right.
That's how deluded we are. Let's say, where the Green Party has come into power, most noticeably in Germany, has formed coalition governments with the established ruling parties in order to implement policies of austerity, war, and repression. So, yeah. But that's because Green Parties in Europe aren't socialists.
Nah.
They're just anti-war environmentalists. They're what they're supposed to be. And it's kind of always been a fight in America of whether we are an eco-socialist party or that. And whether what kind of part, you know, we can't really know because we're not in a parliamentary system.
I've looked at the German political parties, and I've got to say, Die Linke is probably my favorite out of all of them.
Yeah, they're the actual socialists. One wonders if anyone involved in MMP has bothered to examine the politics and record of. Oh, okay, sorry. Let me step back. An indication of what the MMP hopes to achieve, if it were to actually build anything, was given by Brana toward the conclusion when he held up as models Miranda, which is a national regen movement, President Andres Manuel López Obrador in Mexico, and Syriza in Greece, and the Podemos Party in Spain. One wonders if anyone involved in the MPP had bothered to examine the politics and record of the individuals and organizations to which they refer. Syriza and its leader, Elias Tsipras, came to power in Greece in 2015, pledging to end European Union austerity, only to impose it.
Oh, wow.
They went all back. Did you know about this?
Who would have thought?
Yes. So basically, all of those examples haven't been bastions of progressive action. They've all folded to capitalist power one way or the other because, well, they weren't independent.
Exactly.
In Spain, the populist Podemos Party joined a coalition government with the established socialist party, in quotes, because they're like the liberals, in January this year. Since coming to power, Podemos has hailed the 750 billion European bailout of banks and corporations as part of the ruling class's response to coronavirus pandemic. You know, they've had to go along with the same pandemic response that we've done here in America.
Yeah.
So they just become the managers of capitalism, no matter how progressive they are. They just get a little bit more crumbs. In relation to the Sanders campaign, no one posed, let alone answered, the question, how did we get fooled again? How did the political revolution that we championed end up in a campaign behind Biden, that stalwart of political corruption and reaction? No one will acknowledge that the outcome had been predicted by the World Socialist website, as this would be to acknowledge the correctness of Marxism. I just find that paragraph funny. It's true.
Yeah.
Lefties like this, or me, or you, if you were in the past, or Howie, for example, you know, Howie. We've been right all along. Don't want to do too sneering, you know, I told you so, but just like a, just kind of, a, hey, yeah. You know, did you listen to me before? Maybe try listening now. Maybe reassess. But, you know, in a way that addresses all the other perspectives that were maybe ignored before. Or were listened to, but then disregarded for being right. Unpragmatic. And, well, I don't want to be losers like you.
Yeah.
Well, now you're losers too. So stop attacking us. This politics by eclectic amalgam is expressed in the name itself, the People's Party. But what are the people? The use of the term is above all aimed at clearly opposing the MMP to working class politics, that is, a socialist one. One can venture a prediction that the August 30th convention will be the last time that the various individuals who formed it will all come together. In any case, for workers and youth who are seeking a way to oppose inequality, war, and dictatorship, its main purpose is to provide a lesson in what serious politics is not. Okay, we have time for one more thing. This is from a blog called Benjamin Studebaker.
Okay.
Yet another attempt to make the world a better place by writing things. And this is, to round things out, the left case against supporting Joe Biden in the general election. So maybe I could have read this earlier. It dovetails with some of the other paragraphs we read.
Yeah.
It's just going a little harder about how that it actually would be worse if Biden won. So this is the really like kind of unique take that I want to share. At the Dem convention, Bernie Sanders argued that the left should hold its nose and vote for Joe Biden. Quoting him, "The future of democracy is at stake. The future of our economy is at stake. The future of our planet is at stake. We must come together to defeat Donald Trump and elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as president and vice president. My friends, the price of failure is just too great to imagine." My friend Nathan Robinson at Current Affairs made a similar argument. Nathan Robinson is an anarchist, by the way. Claiming that this is our last chance to stop Donald Trump and that we will be fighting for our lives against an aspiring dictator if he wins. You need the levers of power if you're going to be the autocrat, and he doesn't have that.
Yet,
but I guess... And that's the thing. All these liberals will turn so easily.
Yeah.
They're really lying when they say, like, they really oppose this stuff. I don't believe them. I don't.
Right.
I just don't. Like, if Trump is the bastion of law and order and real American values and... the American history that he's purporting, you know, with his statue park and stuff, like, well, I'm for Thomas Jefferson, and all these leftists who don't like Thomas Jefferson, well, I guess I'm, you know, okay with the, it's practical to side with the dictator. That's what happens in other countries. That's what happens historically.
Yeah.
So it's just, we got to prepare for the worst. This is, and others are just like, again, like, what are the liberals going to do when the last chance to stop despotism happens? What do they do next? They're going to fold. That's what makes me angry the most.
Yeah.
And this is kind of where this is a grave mistake. Trump, for all his faults, poses no existential threat to the republic. What's more, Sanders and Robinson are deeply underestimating the danger or the damage of a Biden presidency that will cause. So it's not damage control. It's not buying more time. I mean, if it was about buying time, that's what the last decade was. That was the time that we had to organize.
Right.
So it's too late, I guess. You know, it's never too late, of course. That's my optimistic radicalism, which is like, we're just going to keep pushing forward. The only way out is through. The Republican Party has become what it is because of Democrats like Joe Biden. These Democrats are pushing the Republican Party further and further right, and a Biden presidency will make the Republican Party even more dangerous going forward. Let me show you how that works. So I think we've these points have been covered by many others before, so I'm not sure why. Well, anyone who's basically like I'm not voting for Biden because of this, you know, right. That's why it's okay. They're not agreeing with this is the last chance. The last chance was never even in the past, because like this is the system we have. It's the system that we have. And if it's transforming, and it's transforming for the worse, which is Chris Hedges' point of view, it's going to happen whatever we do. Donald Trump doesn't pose an existential threat to democracy. Let's see. And this is where he mentions that he doesn't have... He points out that Viktor Orban in Hungary used the coronavirus to consolidate power around himself, but Trump responded to the virus by running away from decision-making responsibility instead. He kicked decisions to governors and mayors, which is the real thing that's happening.
Yeah.
That's going local and regionally, and that federal power is disintegrating. At least that's what Trump facilitates. Coronavirus gave Trump an opportunity to centralize power around himself, but he chose to decentralize it instead. He likes the trappings of power, but is afraid of the real deal. Trump talks a big game about cutting trade links with countries all over the world, but his trade wars usually bring us back to where we started, with trade deals that are almost indistinguishable from those that came before. His new version of NAFTA is virtually identical to the old one. He has tried to push jobs and investment out of China, but they've been sliding down the coast of Vietnam instead and returning to America. His bark is worse than his bite. Ultimately, an authoritarian needs the backing of the military. The military has to allow the authoritarian to hold sham elections or to ignore the results of those elections that are free and fair, but which they are not here in America, but in the U.S. But America's leading generals largely despise the president. Our intelligence services loathe him. The military remains committed to the Constitution and will arrest Trump if he attempts to carry on with, after losing. And that's why he suggests delaying the election. He knows he could lose, and he knows that if he loses, he won't be able to keep going. Trump has treated protesters terribly, but it's not the first American president to do so, for sure. The Democrats said Bush had an imperial presidency. Then Barack Obama tried to outflank Congress with a series of outrageous, unconstitutional executive orders, and many of the same people cheered him on. Now when Donald Trump throws out piles of orders, that is probably unconstitutional. The Democrats try to get us outraged again. But the American people are used to the president trying to get away with these things. Obama just made it cool.
Yeah.
Many of Obama's unconstitutional orders were struck down by the courts. The Democrats tell us that we should be worried that Trump is packing courts full of stooges who will approve of anything and everything he does. But judges aren't very predictable. Neil Gorsuch has already voted against the president's wishes on transgender employees. John Roberts increasingly votes against the president's wishes to protect the court's legitimacy. Many of the court's liberals have historically been appointed by Republicans. Earl Warren was appointed by Eisenhower. John Paul Stevens was appointed by Ford. David Sorter was appointed by H.W. Bush.
Wow.
Even if Trump really does pack the court, many on the left have called for packing the judiciary or reforming its structure. In the past, they have suggested doing this simply because they don't agree with the politics of current judges, not because they believe that judges are authoritarian. If it's really the case that Trump manages to load the judiciary up with raving authoritarian nationalists, the judicial reforms already under consideration by the left could be used to undo the damage. Assuming you could pass any reform.
Yeah.
The real concern is not, and based on, say, the Dems take back the Senate, they're not passing shit.
No.
The real concern is not a president who's is allied with judges, it's the authoritarian ruler who's allied with the military. Trump alienated all the leading figures in the armed forces by ignoring their advice, leaking classified info, and blatantly disparaging them both.
Yeah.
Yada yada. Trump burped once. He burped in their direction. We need to articulate a compelling left-wing alternative to politics of the past 40 years. That's what this show's about. When Republicans are in office, we flip out over every little thing they do. We oppose it all. People who reject the status quo come to the left, and it was tiring to me even when W was in office. We oppose it all. People who reject the status quo come to the left to look to the left for the new way forward. But when Democrats are in office, there is no meaningful left-wing opposition. Intellectuals point out the failings of Democratic presidents, but they are derided as bad sports. People who reject the status quo are pushed toward the Republicans and pushed into nationalism. And here's the parting thoughts of the show. A Biden administration will create a whole new generation of bad Democrats. The left hopes that replacing Trump with Biden will buy the left time. But Biden will pack his administration full of a whole new generation of vulgar careerists. It will be these people, not the left, who inherit the Democratic Party when he leaves.
Like Pete Buttigieg.
Exactly. They will have the institutional knowledge and connections, like the Politico article that pointed out. They will continue servicing the oligarchs, and the Republican Party will respond by growing ever more bellicose, ever more grandiose, ever more willing to tear the whole thing down. Biden will accelerate the rise of new nationalist figures who might be able to do all the things Trump can't even dream of doing. So here's that. Here's the grand take of the episode. Biden voters, you're the real accelerationists. We can't have that, and for that reason, I can't support Biden, even as a matter of strategy. To give the left more time, we need to give the left something to oppose. Now, when Trump won, Hawkins' observation, or his line post-election, was, we're stronger in opposition.
Yeah.
Which, weird, because our vote totals only kind of grew with Stein during the Obama years. So, I'm not quite sure, but, like, certainly, both can be true. We can oppose the Trump administration in a second term, but if it's Biden, we'll be stuck defending him as he slugs the ordinary American in the face.
Yeah.
The American. Yeah. Come on, fat. Take it like a man.
Fat.
Get evicted like a man. You got your chance. The American people won't forget the black eye we've given them, and they'll vote for the leaders who will be the death of us. So I don't know where this guy is, like, coming from, but maybe he's a Democrat, but, like, he shouldn't be at this point. maybe he's just a independent with a capital I.
Yeah.
As many kind of commentators and free-thinking people are. But see, again, they'll vote green maybe, but they don't think we're the right vehicle. Maybe because we're not militant enough. Maybe because we're too militant.
Yeah.
It's all a matter of degrees and taste. And
yeah.
And I ran about that over and over. I want to point out that the week before last, I was on two podcasts, which have now been, one's been released. I did an interview with the Hampton Institute.
Ooh.
Where I talked about myself and my political journey and local politics and politicking as it speaks to left strategy.
Hmm.
And the next one was with two progressive, one socialist, one progressive Texans, who run the Real Left Christian page.
Oh, I love that page.
Yeah, and so I did a Skype call with them, and kind of gave the independent left pitch in full and as much as possible, because I know their listenership is thirsty for such knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
They want these perspectives. When you don't get them, something feels wrong. And that's kind of how I felt listening to podcast after podcast, 09 to 2012. Like, all these different shows that will still kind of just talk like, again, Dems are the only show in town. Our strategies are all based around how we think we can influence them. But more and more, especially since Citizens United, that should have been like the death knell. That's why I did Occupy. That's why a lot of us did Occupy and went to direct action and anarchism and radicalism. We were radicalized because we could see that through such court rulings by, you know, a balanced court.
Yeah.
For the most part. Maybe it was conservative led. I forget. Can't really tell, more or less, to me.
Yeah.
That this whole influencing the major party is doomed. Yeah. It was even when, after a decade of apparently progressive momentum with the Sanders movement, all this mass fundraising, still not enough to actually run competitive races in Dem primaries. Now, can you do it outside of that? Currently, no, of course not. We need some mass movement party that, you know, but see, then it becomes a fight of, does the mass movement party have to be anti-capitalist? We would say yes. Others would say, of course not. There's too many people who believe that free market enterprise is what capitalism is. But, and they're too much of a coward, in my opinion, to say that, no, monopoly is capitalism. Free market enterprise is what socialism can provide. The ability for state banks and public banks and community banks to fund whatever little project or enterprise you want to do. You know, with low cost loans, so with loans that are on the pennies and interest, you know. So, any other parting thoughts?
My parting thought is I've figured out what Donald Trump's dream job is. I think Trump wants to be a constitutional monarch in that he wants all of the trappings of power, all of the pageantry, and he doesn't want to actually do shit. He just wants to be a figurehead. He
wants to be the queen.
Yeah, he wants to be the queen. Yeah, that's exactly what he wants.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people want to live that life. What do you think half all of our fantasy stories are? They're about nobles or monarchs and people who like...
Or people of noble birth.
Or have the choice, the ability to choose between taking responsibility for a common good and they're heroic for that. Or they are breaking out of that like stodgy responsibility that's put upon them at birth for the sake of the fact that they're expected that they will be educated. Which is really what nobility was really about. You were a noble because you had the resources to be educated or the ability to not have to work so you could be educated and thus you were the people who could read.
Right.
Yeah. So, my profound thanks for listening. An important skill is important as talking, so I plan to listen to any constructive feedback sent in, ideas for the show, stories, or topics you'd like to hear discussed. We have a Patreon page. We have a Facebook and Twitter pages. Please like and share them. Any kind of reviews on podcasting apps, because the show is found on any and all most podcasting apps. I have updated the archive with the first half of the year, so you can listen to half up to July 2020 episodes on 3lefts.news, www.3lefts.news. Thanks. Till next time, keep waving the flags of the Three Lefts.
I had my headphones on facing the wrong direction for a good while.
Bop, like, bop.
I was just wondering, why do my ears hurt so much? And I was like, oh,
like most change, you have to notice the pain before you act.
Yeah.
Right? Things could be wrong for a while.